This session, we're calling the Year of Food and Farmers. And the reason it carries that name is because that's really what it's about. National Geographic is preparing to do a Year of Food. And I first want to introduce our guest from National Geographic, Dennis Dimmick. I've gotten to know Dennis pretty well over the last year and some, and had an opportunity to watch him think. And he's walked us and others through a very sophisticated editorial process that National Geographic has gone through in putting together this Year of Food. He's the executive editor of the Environment with National Geographic Magazine and National Geographic Society. He leads their coverage of environment, energy, and climate issues, which is a very, very big portfolio, and has really been a key driver in shaping the magazine's award-winning environmental reporting since 2003. He's produced magazine stories, really in-depth magazine stories, on very big issues: conservation, public lands, wilderness, climate, Great Plains, wetlands. He's edited an encyclopedia of world geography, books on the world's deserts, wildlife refuges, and the Endangered Species Act. Big, big topics. And the challenge there, of course, is to make them compelling, digestible, understandable. In the past year alone, he's presented at the Aspen Environment Forum, Yale Institute for Biospheric Studies, Earth System Initiative at MIT, United Nations Environmental Programs World Environment Day, and he worked with us at GW with our Planet Forward Feeding the Planet initiative. And I have to tell you that we had students from across the country there, and we went to one group that was coming in from one of the schools from across the country and said, "You want to have lunch with Dennis Dimmick?" They said, "Oh, my God, lunch with Dennis? Are you kidding, Dimmick?" And so he's a bit of a rock star, too, although he's kind of an unassuming one when you first meet him. He, even more importantly, connects with this topic from his earliest days because he holds degrees in agriculture and journalism from Oregon State University and from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Dennis Dimmick to the stage.
So one minor correction to the biography. It is agriculture journalism from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Giving a shout to the Badgers. Thank you very much. So I'm of you guys. So I grew up on a farm, right? And here's the story. So the future of food, that's the name of our project for 2014. I'll get into that, but okay, we have to do the obligatory social media thing. There's my Twitter handle. I've been on it since 2009, so more of you can be too, okay? I'm 63, so I'm old. I can do this stuff, right? Here's my story. So I grew up in the Willamette Valley of Oregon on a farm. This is where I was when I was a little over a year old, just south of Portland. It has since been taken over by an interstate highway. This is how I earned money to go to college, okay? Baling hay, raised purebred Suffolk sheep, but this is how I made the cash to get my agriculture degree from Oregon State. And when I was about 20, I picked up a camera, started photographing. This is one of the first published pictures. This is my younger brother, Rick. We raised purebred registered Suffolk sheep. I showed him at the county and the state fairs. Apologies to the pitchfork motif. This was my, in the mid-80s, I was in my later Grant Wood American Gothic phase as a photographer. This is real corn. This is real barn. This is my folks. They're both gone now. But anyway, that's where it all began. And then, so then I went to school and spent 6 years as a newspaper journalist. My first job out of college was as the sports editor and farm editor at the McMinnville, Oregon News Register. So then fast forward to the Geographic. I went there in 80, and I've been involved in covering environmental issues for a long time. Climate change 10 years ago, disappearing ice, energy, biofuels, fracking, a special issue on water in 2010, and a year-long series on population in 2011. And all these things, they're big questions, but we're a global magazine. We have a global readership. We have like 36 or 39 local language editions. But all along the way, for me, this question about agriculture and food has always been underlying. And here, for example, on the cover of the magazine in September 2008, it took me 9 years to get this story published in the magazine. But where does food begin? It begins with soil. To try to begin to have a conversation with readers about where food comes from, to me, is radical in today's environment. And it all gets down to the success of a civilization is often going to be determined by the soil that they inherit and care for or not. Here, for example, Kansas and Syria. Tell me which country of those two is more peaceable and more productive. It's not hard to see by just looking at the picture. So, not just soil. I mean, 12 years ago, we did a couple stories on food safety. We did an early piece on genetic engineered crops. In 2004, I worked with the photographer Jim Richardson of Belleville, Kansas. He's now in Lindsborg. I've known him for 40 years. We did a big piece on the Great Plains and how the plains have had to adapt after the big environmental disaster of the Dust Bowl in the 30s, and what's different now and how people are responding. In 2009, after the big price spikes of 2008 and people were falling off the edge of the food wagon, we did a big piece on why that is and why we're coming up against limits. And it actually became the prototype, actually the framework for this series that we're doing this year. And 2011, as part of the population series, we did a piece on the preservation of genetic diversity in the food system. This is Carrie Fowler from the Global Crop Diversity Trust, another Jim Richardson picture. Preserving the things that are the basis and the root for the cereal crops that we all need to survive. Here it is, UG99 in Ethiopia. That's it, the wheat stem virus that's moving across to Africa and the Middle East and threatens wheat harvests. So all that's kind of prologue, but it's a setup, but helps set a stage for, you know. So we kind of have two conversations going on. One is like, well, what shall we have for dinner? As if we have a choice and we can make a choice, and we're in a culture that has a lot of opportunity to make those choices. But increasingly around the world, increasingly for more people, the more compelling question is, will there even be dinner? That, to me, is perhaps an operative idea as to why I began promoting this idea that what was the next question that we needed to answer after climate, energy, water, population, but what's going to be for lunch? What's for dinner? And, you know, we've met the challenge before, and Julie was here today, and you know, to me, you know, the work that Simit did in the 50s in Mexico, it was so transformative. It was publicly funded research. This is the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Institute, where the work was done, where Dr. Borlaug did the hybridization of the wheat varieties that helped stave off hunger around the world in the 60s. And it also occurred at Erie in the Philippines with rice. All that stuff was transformative. It saved the world from itself 50 years ago. And so the question to me now is, why food now? Why are we doing this? Well, I think then you have to get out of the food question and you have to start looking at the world itself, the bigger world that we're all trying to live and survive in. And it's like this. In 1900, there were 1.6 billion of us. And do a little numeric jujitsu, a century later, there's 6.1. Go forward another, 13 years, add another billion. And, you know, the numbers are 9.6, 9.7, whatever, but the general gist is, like, that's a lot of people that you're going to have to figure out how to feed. And most of them are going to be living in cities. By mid-century, there will be more people living in cities than are alive today. And so let's talk about our food system, but you have to talk about our earth system, really. Because what it is the whole thing is run by this. It's all run by sun power, either current or ancient. And that's part of this, where does agriculture fit into a bigger question? Photosynthesis, it's the root of everything. Current, ancient, that's what's kept life alive. It's the heart of crops today. And it's also this whole idea of it's not just agriculture, it's all plant life. And when you look at this algae in this water, what you're really seeing is a few hundred years from now, that stuff is going to turn into fossil sunlight. And about 300 years ago, we figured out that essentially fossil sunlight, all it is what hydrocarbon fossil fuels are, just the fossilized carbons of 400 million year-old plants and animals that we dig up and light on fire. That's basically how we run things. And so we have coal, and we dig it up, and it's a wonderful energy source, but we flatten mountains to get at it. And in America, you know, our reliance on coal has gone down because we discovered fracking, but globally, our reliance on coal has gone up faster in the last 12 years than any other energy source combined. And when you're living in a global environment and a global climate, that matters because it changes the envelope that you're living in. But it keeps the lights on, right? Keeps the party going. Or oil. How about oil? It turns the wheels of everything. This is a boreal forest in Canada, and this is what happens when you get oil sands. You take the forest away, you scrape off the bitumen that's called, and you turn it into oil. They're the largest international supplier of oil to the United States today. But we got to keep the wheels going for society and also for agriculture. Agriculture is deeply embedded in a fossil fuel economy. And there's another dimension to it. It's natural gas. So about 100 years ago, two German scientists, Haber and Bosch, invented the process of synthesizing nitrogen from the atmosphere. That was transformative. The Canadian scientist Vaclav Smil has called the invention of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer the igniter of the population bomb. It was the catalyst. When you look at population curves from the middle of the last century on, it had a huge impact. Cheap energy, cheap nitrogen, it allowed us to mechanize landscapes. It allowed us to develop herbicides, pesticides, all the things that allow crops to thrive. Energy gave us the ability to pump water from deep aquifers, to turn the deserts into something blooming. This is a tomato field in Saudi Arabia. They're running out of water because they've mined all their water. So in one sense, we're richer. We've got cities everywhere, highways. We're building suburbs as far as the eye can see, often now on some of the best farmland. And we consume more. This picture, everything you see in this picture comes from oil. Okay? We're embedded in a fossil energy economy to do things much more than to just turn the wheels and keep the lights on. And we're also eating up the food chain. We're moving up the food chain globally. You know, and it needs to be said, some of the most productive farmland in the world. This is Iowa corn country. Most of that harvest goes to feed cows, cars, and make sugar. Not a lot of it goes to feed people directly. And soybeans is a great food additive. It improves rate of gain. It's great, but what we're doing is we're also feeding a livestock economy. It's a global thing. Follow the money. There's money to be made by growing crops and sending them to China because China wants to live like us, right? Might be a growth business for cardiologists in time, but they want to do that. And there's a price to all this plenty, and we need to admit it. I'm trying to have a conversation not about within agriculture, but about agriculture as it fits into the larger global framework. So we cut our forests. We have annual crops that, you know, aren't covering the land, but maybe 40% of the year. We continue to suffer soil erosion problems. We have nutrient runoff problems. We're not using our fertilizers as efficiently as we could, right? There's a reason dead zones exist in the Chesapeake Bay and at the end of the Mississippi River system. It's because of nutrient runoff, nutrients, phosphates, the whole deal. We're mining aquifers. It's all good as far as if we're making a near-term profit, but in the long term, like here, the Colorado River hardly ever makes it to the sea most years. This is the Yellow River in China. There's a price to all this. And this is the one for me that's the most interesting. If you're in agriculture, it's like, look, I grew up with this idea. It's like, it's all good if the rain falls in the right amount at the right time, spaced out over the right proportions. But what's happening now, this is 60 years of global temperature measurements, okay? The envelope that we're living in is changing. It's warming up. It's changing the behavior of the weather that we're having to deal with as agriculturalists, as farmers, as people who are trying to grow food. So how to meet this? How to meet this challenge? It's really, to me, it's a really interesting conundrum. Here we are, we're at 7 billion, we're going to 9 plus. We're seeing an increasingly unstable climate system. That's a real risk management question. And so that's really sort of the backstory, the why. Why now? Why food now? Because it's a compelling question that the public needs to become engaged in. Not the people inside agriculture. We're already paying attention. I'm trying to get people outside of this to start understanding that food comes from someplace other than the grocery store. And we had a huge cultural shift in this country. You know, from the middle of the last century, you know, a lot of us either grew up on farms or we knew somebody who was on a farm, we had a relative on a farm. There's been a huge urban migration. We've become disconnected from the things that keep us alive. And that's one of the key reasons that we're trying to do this project, because it's important. It's all we're really trying to do, just like with energy and climate and water and population. We're just trying to create a conversation for people to get them back to source. Where does this really come from? And so we're going to be doing a series of stories starting in May. Feeding 9 billion, aquaculture, can Africa feed the world, or itself for that matter? Hunger in America, yes sir, we're going to point the lens right here at the United States. How human diet has evolved and what that has meant for us. Genetics, we're going to deal with it. How much meat? That's a big question. And the whole thing about food and culture in our life. So I'm just going to run through a few things. These are all, you know, they're not done yet, so, you know, don't be like quoting. It's like this is like, you know, those publisher's proofs you get for the book reviews. It says please don't quote until you talk to the source. Okay, so anyway, the opening story, May, written by John Foley of the University of Minnesota. He wrote an interesting paper in Nature 3 years ago. If you haven't read it, you ought to read it. It's Solutions for a Cultivated Planet. And some will argue it's naive, but it's actually the first time I ever read anything that actually began to frame out the questions and the opportunities that we face globally and how we're going to meet these challenges. And in this story, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to paint the picture of what agriculture is like. It's a huge enterprise, most transformative enterprise on the face of the earth, right? And people have no idea what it's like. We're trying to help them understand. And beyond that, though, it's like the people, the farmers. I am terribly interested in showing people to our readers, the people who grow the food that we all eat, that we all rely on. Somebody has to do it. Somebody's out there. And so we're trying to help people realize it's not a machine, it's people that make the difference. And you can have a wheat farmer in South Dakota, and you can have rice farmers in Bangladesh, and they're all out there. They're all trying to do the same thing, and it's a noble effort. And it's a big thing, and we continue to keep cutting forests. And it's an incredibly industrial-scale thing. We're just trying to sort of help connect people back to source. And this, apologies to our sponsors, but this is a Monsanto greenhouse. This actually, to me, is one of the most interesting areas. And, you know, we've been talking all day about GMOs. Let me talk a little bit about marker-assisted breeding. And that's using genomics, and it's using the same stuff as the people who are introducing novel genes. But what you can do by using genomics is you can speed up hybridization. You can improve the rate of return on your conventional plant breeding. And that's what they're doing right here. They're trying to breed crops that are more nutrient efficient, more water efficient. I think that's the part of the discussion about when we start talking about genetics and plants is what can we do to improve the lives of farmers and the productivity of farmers? And that's what we're going to try to get at in this project. And so then also, you know, this thing about aquaculture, I think it's fascinating in one sense because it's, we've farmed the land for 10,000 years. And only until very recently we were fishing the sea, And yet, we've fished out most of the big fish. What role and opportunity for actually farming the ocean? Using the ocean as essentially as a farm. And so we're going to get at that idea because that has great potential for producing protein. And these are shrimp farmers in Bangladesh. Here, this is an underwater, I think this is in British Columbia. But what's interesting, though, is conversion ratios. And if you see the chart on the right, this will be in our piece. It's like you look across and it's like, we know. Look, I took animal science. It's all about feed conversion ratio. What do you get out of a pound of feed in? And if you look over there on the right, some of these fish get a pound out for a pound in. And chickens and pigs and beef from right to left, they have much less efficiency. And so we're just trying, what we're really trying to do is to begin to unpack this whole issue, expand the idea so that people get a sense of like, oh, where does this come from, really? These are ocean-going, they'd be like paddocks, floating paddocks that have fish inside. Then the question, I think one of the bigger questions really is, you know, we've heard about this land grab issue and like, oh, big rich countries coming in and investing in Africa or in Eastern Europe or in South America to long-term leases, buy up land. We're just really trying to get a sense here of like, well, can Africa feed itself? And what benefits really? Maybe there's not white hats or black hats. Maybe there's a combination of both here. And so, you know, you have a continent and in large measure it says practices agriculture as if it's still in medieval times. Yet on the other hand, you are beginning to see big, large-scale farming operations. This is a place called Bananalandia, I think, in Mozambique. But we're also seeing the presence of international investors and international specialists. And I think it's a really interesting question as far as Africa goes. So if you had no infrastructure and you had no capacity to improve your productivity, actually, is it such a bad idea that somebody comes in and helps build roads and build irrigation systems and all the kinds of things that are necessary to actually build a civil society and a productive agricultural system? You know, there's no easy answers, but I think it's also if you can go in and you can help people. The question is really not about paternalism. It's about how can people help themselves, and you're trying to help that. And already we have some places, I think this was in Somalia, they're already have a huge livestock export to the Arabian Peninsula. This one is a hard one, but I think it's necessary to take a look at. And there's this question of you have upwards of 40 million people in the United States who are food insecure, and why is that? And so what we're trying to do here is to look at the incentive systems, and this is in Iowa, this is in the Bronx, this is in Houston. There's a variety of different reasons why it's difficult for some people. Obviously, it's poverty. Sometimes it's what's called food deserts. Sometimes it's just the inability to get access to things like fresh fruits and vegetables. So we try to, you know, we try to look at this. It's something that needs to be done. The map is showing actually the counties that have the highest percentage of SNAP recipients. Also, we're going to just deal with this question. I think it's a question that has to be addressed. So you have government subsidies for commodity crops. Whether it's subsidies or now it's crop insurance, it's under a different guise under the new legislation, but it's still money, right? Yet at the same time, if you go to the USDA's food pyramid and you say to people, so what's the healthy diet? If you look at it, half that plate's supposed to have fruits and vegetables on it, but do you see equivalent support for those kinds of farmers in farm legislation? No. So those are the pieces that we've put together. So you're really just kind of getting a preview, but it's not just the feature things. We're trying to do short things. I think part of it here is we struggle here because it's like, well, we can't make it like medicine. We got to make people interested and intrigued by this thing. It's like, oh, I had no idea. So it's like the diversity of different kinds of apples, a little two-page thing. Or where are the different pieces of a chicken? If everybody eats chicken, do you have any idea where all the pieces come from? Or the history and development of forks. It's okay. You know, if you give people just a little bit of something, they might go, oh, I had no idea. Well, that's interesting. Maybe I'll go back to their website for more. Or how about food miles? This is food miles. This is All this stuff was bought in like a three-block area in stores in New York, and then on the same day, and then this chart will show us where it all comes from so that you can see how many miles everything traveled. This is meals ready to eat. What's in those things? Well, we unpack them for you, okay? Food facts. We're going to be doing food facts every month. Little things, just so people kind of go, oh, really? This is a spread that we're going to do on women farmers and why there aren't more of them, and talk about the educational barriers, the financial barriers, the land ownership barriers, and what the benefits would come if you actually had more women who were farmers and were in the decision-making role. So as I get, you know, here at the end, it's like, and we're going to be online. And this is just a prototype of what we've got. So we're trying to, you know, we're trying to get with the 21st century on new-looking websites. We're trying to start a conversation here. And if you want to subscribe to our food facts and email, you can. It'll all be there. And it's not just a magazine thing. It's going to be across the society, the channel. Our channel is going to have a series. We're going to have a museum exhibit that was originally at the American Museum of Natural History, adult and kids books, Geography Awareness Week. That means schools, kids, and teachers are going to be involved in this. And our new CEO, Gary Nell, who just came to us from NPR, headed Children's Television Workshop for 12 years. So I'm guaranteed that we're going to have kids engaged in this project. We'll have public events, and our research explorers and grantees will be involved too. So that's the future of food. The URL, natgeofood.com, hashtag future of food, starting April 15th. Thank you.
I told you so. That was fabulous, really fabulous. And Dennis will come back up and we'll engage and take your questions in just a few minutes. But I thought that was just an amazing presentation and gives you some sense. Talk about scale. How great it would be to have the resources of a National Geographic behind you when you're launching a project like this. I'd like to bring up someone who's going to engage this story with a different medium and from a different perspective, but with no less thought and perhaps impact. Randy Krotz is the executive director of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. And the, if you didn't know, the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance is a movement that now consists of nearly 80 farmer and rancher-led organizations and industry partners that represent virtually every aspect of agriculture. And they work to communicate across the spectrum with consumers who have questions about how food is grown and raised, connecting them with those who do the growing and raising, and with a laudable goal of advancing public discourse, debate where necessary. And he oversees the organization's day-to-day management. I'm really excited that he's here today, and I think you will be as well, because he and they have produced a feature film. And the feature film, documentary film, Farmland, the movie, which will be released in the spring.
We are very, very proud of this project, as you can imagine. It's been something that's gone on for some time at U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, and it's really a very exciting look at a group, six young farmers. And let me just, before I go any further, if I could ask you all, so this is still an embargoed film. We're still presenting the film to film festivals and trying to get it into some film festivals. So as much as we're going to show you a piece of the film, what you see in the film, if you would please not write about it, I very much appreciate it. Obviously, the trailer's all yours. It's public consumption. But I would like to show you the film, 5 or 6 minutes of it, just to give you a sense of what's at stake here. And really, it's trying to, as Dennis talked about, creating a dialogue, starting a dialogue. And that's what these folks are after. It's not about production practices, although we're very proud that many production practices are represented in the film. We have a local producer. The female producer is in Pennsylvania. We have a large organic producer in Southern California, pork producer in Minnesota, poultry producer in Georgia, corn and soybean producer in Nebraska, and I may be leaving out one. But it's very exciting. In fact, the film subjects are going to be here on Friday for our press conference, where you guys will have an opportunity to interview those folks. And again, it's not about production practices or anything, as much as it is the generational shift of agriculture. These are all folks, again, in their 20s that are taking over or starting a farm that supports their families. So what we know and what made us walk down this path was what doing research about what consumers want to hear and how they want to receive it. And it's interesting. We all know there's no silver bullet, and we've learned that over and over with research. You know, for a long time, we used phrases like safe, affordable, and abundant, and we know those are effective, but we also know that some consumers shut off to those terms, particularly these sophisticated food connectors that want to hear more and have more transparency. We also know there's 80 million millennials out there today in the United States, and they really want to consume their information in a very different manner than what we have previously. They want to trust. They want to see things on a label. People that are 20 to 30, consumers that are 20 to 30 years of age want something very different on their food label than maybe what I do or what my expectations are. So we've learned so many things as we've walked through and prepared to do a film like this. We have U.S. consumers are 75% believe their food supply is safe. We have the safest food in the world, right? But there still are concerns about where their food comes from, and people want to learn more and more. So we're not going to shift anybody's opinion with a 75-minute film, but we've done research, and what consumers come out of this film with is an open mind, a bit opened up about the issues that these producers talk about in the film, which is topics like animal welfare, the use of antibiotics, GMOs. It's really very powerful to hear a farmer talk about how he or she treats their animals. There's no better messenger.
Two very different approaches to telling a very complicated story. And I'm wondering if both of you would talk for a little bit about what constitutes success. Okay, you know, you begin in sorts of film festivals, you talked about your research and how you change, but what do you want to come out of this? What do you want to come out of this year of food? Go ahead, Randy.
Well, I would say, you know, that we're a society today that listens closely to all voices, and that's great. There are some voices out there around food production that aren't necessarily always fair and sometimes fabricate positions of how food is raised or grown in order to drive a position for a particular food or product. I think success would be to get consumers to asking more questions, to having them want to dialogue with all producers and understand better that just to be very direct, when you see a Chipotle ad that does what it does to agriculture and tells such a fabricated story of food production, that consumers don't necessarily fall for that.
And are you building a whole digital presence around this, as these guys are, to have that conversation?
Well, I don't know if anybody can do what it was. I had a whole set of slides, and I decided not to show them because how do you follow that, right? But yeah, absolutely, there is a digital presence to it, and truly, we're trying to build the farm base for the film. But it is a national launch. The agriculture is not the target for this film. I think everybody here recognizes that. Our goal is to get it launched, and we are launching into the top 25 markets in the U.S. And we want to expand that launch.
What's success for you?
Point to two things that I noticed. There was the interview that you did with the kid outside the Whole Foods who didn't really know where food came from. And then the interesting quote from the young farmer here saying that, what do they want to know? If we only knew what it was they wanted to know, that's what we're trying to get at. We're trying to help actually create or even recreate a sense of this whole structure of where food comes from. So if there's an opportunity there for this thing to become part of a conversation, not something that's every 5 years because there's, you know, a trillion-dollar farm bill pending, but it becomes a more natural part of everybody's life. It's like this issue is really not on the radar of the public mind. 10 years ago, we did a big project on climate change. And shortly after that, an engineer from the National Renewable Energy Lab wrote us and said, thank God you did that, because now it's okay to talk about it in America. And I think in one sense, that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to inoculate a discussion. And we don't know how it's going to go. And it may be that the most valuable target audience is going to be the kids.
You said 80 million millennials.
Yeah.
That's who is standing in front of Whole Foods, thinking that's where food comes from,
right,
saying he doesn't know where food comes from.
Right.
How do you get your magazine and this information to the millennials? How do you get your film to the millennials?
Well, I mean, obviously, we are dealing with a generation that doesn't necessarily read Dead Trees Media. So we're acknowledging that, and that's why we have such a...
That's a great name for a company. We should start a company.
DTM.org, yeah? Definitely not .com.
But is there a big marketing push to get to millennials? I know you have a pretty good... National Geographic is seen by a ton of young people.
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that, for example, we have we're planning when all the computer hackers come together and they're going to write programs that are going to help solve...
Hackathon,
that's it. We're going to have that, and we're going to have a public event, but I don't know yet.
And you're going into schools?
Yes, the education part of the seed. We have a big educational group at the Geographic that build educational materials. There will be concurrent curriculum, lesson plans, those kinds of things that are going to be made available online to our Geography Education Alliance and anybody else who wants to. So it's more than just this magazine, as I pointed out at the end. It's everybody across the society is trying to make a go of this.
How are you getting to millennials?
I would say that, you know, there are many farm organizations out there that work hard to get to millennials. I know Bayer's a proud sponsor of many of those efforts. From our vantage point with the film, with the documentary that is by James Mole. James is an Academy Award-winning director, an Emmy Award-winning director. We're very proud of that and his participation. But truly, it's to create, it might sound simple, but with the film, it's to create a 44-minute version that can be downloaded, that's going to be shown in schools and college campuses. My son's a senior, and he has seen Food, Inc. 4 times. And that's well and good that there's, you know, both sides, but we need both sides being told in the classroom, and we think this is an opportunity to do that.
Well, I'll invite you now to come to GW, and we'll arrange it for
the screening.
Oh, great.
There you go. I can leave now.
So we talk a lot about storytelling and the need to tell stories. We've heard that here today. And what I loved about the opening scene in the empty barren field with people kind of, you know, with the presumably a husband and wife or some.
That's actually a mom and son in that case.
Don't tell her I
okay.
said that. Don't tell him
I
said that.
I didn't tell her, it'd be fine.
Scratching through the soil, you know, you live it, you breathe it. So as you put this together, and this is a question to both of you, because it's a challenge to all of us when we're trying to report, right, is how do we take an issue and turn it into a story? How do we make it compelling and gripping? So I'd be interested to hear from both of you about the process you went through and how you worked from idea to issue to story.
Ours is probably much more simple. I would say that through research, when the organization was started 2 or 3 years ago, it was very clear that consumers, in fact, research indicates that consumers trust farmers the most in the food chain of anybody. So it's a very powerful voice, and farmers are very interested in using their voice to tell these stories, and it really just blossomed from that. It was how to find different venues, whether it's through what we call our Food Dialogues program, whether it's an enhanced social media program. The Facebook campaign for U.S. farmers and ranchers is extraordinary. We have a tremendous presence in social media. And so the next step in this case was to go down the path of a film. And we're very fortunate to get one of the best storytellers there is to tell the story.
So for us, I mean, the framework is a little different. One, because we're trying to have a global conversation with our, you know, our domestic U.S. readership, and something like 40%+ of our circulation is outside the U.S. in a variety of languages. So what we had to do was really say, what are the big questions globally? And that's why you saw the list of stories. There are others. I mean, the climate part of it is not there, but we'll get at it in other ways. And then once we identified the themes, then we started looking, who can we find who personifies these questions? Like there's a fellow who raises tilapia outside of Washington who was sort of the person that we used as the angle into the story on aquaculture. We find examples of people who are personifying different dimensions of that story. As far as the first story, I mean, that for me, it wasn't necessarily about actually the narrative of the life of some individual farmer, but we were just trying to, when we built that first story, it was like we were trying to show the magnitude of the enterprise. And George Steinmetz, the New Jersey photographer who flies, he puts a paraglider on his back with a propeller, and he flies around and takes pictures. His legs are the landing gear. And then Jim Richardson, the Kansas photographer that Randy knows, I've worked with him for 40 years. Jim and I built a plan on how he was going to go around the world and meet farmers on their land, in their place, to put a face to farming. And then that's how that came together. But typically these kinds of stories, we look for vignettes, we look for somebody who personifies an issue so it's not reading like a report, but it's actually from the inside of somebody's world. And then we come back out and talk about some of the bigger issues.
Do one more, and then we'll turn to your questions. And if you've got a question, raise your hand now, and we'll get a mic right to you. If it takes a minute to come to you, we'll get the mic to you then. We've talked a lot about sort of the, you know, where is the story? Where is the agriculture story going? And what should people in this room, and what should we as news educators and consumers and providers be doing? Obviously, your projects are just now coming out, and so we'll see how they're received and the impact that they have. But what is your sense? You heard the bloggers here earlier, and you've heard, you know, some of the food producers themselves. What is your sense as to where the sharp edge of the food stories, plural, is going now?
I don't know how directly I can answer that, but I know that, you know, 17 or 20 years ago, a few years out of college, I didn't think that there would be a role in food production to defend food, to defend agriculture, to help consumers understand how their food is produced and raised. I think that how that has all culminated, whether it's been from the folks here, the tremendous, you know, digital expertise that now exists in agriculture, I'd put it up against anybody. I can't really, you know, maybe predict, Frank, where the next issue is, but I think what's really unique that's occurred for us is how agriculture and the food industry has come together and is looking at that with more of one eye than what's ever happened in my, you know, 20 years in looking at issues management, crisis management around food production.
Well, you mentioned millennials and how millennials are looking at labels, for example.
Yeah.
Do you think millennials and this desire for more information, more data, always on mobile, all this kind of thing, is that demographic really going to be driving this?
Well, I think so, and I think it's driven, you know the next generation has driven a lot of things. You know, by just the you know, your Twitter account. I mean, everybody's got one, but those guys live it and breathe it. And you know what? Again, what we know is that more information is better. You know, they go in looking at comparative shopping, seeing natural on a label versus natural plus local plus this plus a picture of the farm that it was raised. That stuff.
Well, and
over.
you're gonna now have a QR code, and you could conceivably have a QR code on everything,
right?
That will tell you.
Yeah, the point of purchase, particularly again for these sophisticated consumers, that by the way we all listen to, that we all see in blogospheres, that have a tremendous influence over social media, and their churches, their schools, and their neighborhoods. So it's an important group of people.
Yeah, near term, I think it's reconnecting the discussion about food and agriculture to the general public, which is the reason why we're doing this. And it's not something that's going to be done in a year. I mean, look, I was a VOAG kid in high school. My older brother taught vocational agriculture for 30 years. And a few years after we got out of our high school, they shut down the ag program. You know, they shut down the home ec program. I mean, these kinds of things that were part of our growing up are no longer, they're not even there as part to be available for children to learn about. And that, I think, in the near term is one of the biggest challenges, is how do you educate? Beyond information, it's like, how do you help people understand, educate them about where their place is in the world? And where do they get all the things that keep them going? And that's, I think, what we're trying to do. I think, and then in terms of the knife edge, I mean, I find myself really intrigued, and actually I lay awake at night, this whole question of the disruption of the climate. Mm-hmm. Because agriculture is so dependent upon a pastoral stability. And when you have an increasing frequency of extreme weather events, you have increasing costs for these kinds of things. That's actually one of the biggest things. And people need to understand that adaptation takes a long time. And you can't just brew up a new variety of a crop overnight. It takes a long time. And that's something that I don't think people appreciate, that it takes years. How are you going to build drought tolerance? How are you going to build heat tolerance? How are you going to change cropping systems in the face of changing weather conditions? Those are the kinds of things that we're only going to be having to face more intensely down the line.
But to that, when that technology is ready to come to the market, when an organization like Bayer or others bring that technology to bear for producers or in the food production chain, farmers need the freedom to operate to be able to utilize it. And that's, I think, one of the key elements around, you know, consumers understanding modern agriculture and not being afraid of technology related to food production.
Big leap. Big challenge. Yeah. How about turning for some questions? Over, gentleman on the side here, and I don't know if somebody's already holding a mic, but... There we go.
Randy, I have a question for you. I know that you've tried to create a dialogue with the farmers and ranchers in several different meetings. The question would be, what have they told you? What have the chefs told you? What have the consumers told you that they want to know, and how receptive to your message?
Generally very perceptive. I mean, just the general understanding of food production is what comes, and you maybe everybody in the room has experienced that, whether you've watched it happen for a chef, whether you've seen it happen for a consumer. Some of these blog get-togethers, when you do it out at a ranch, and what it means to mommy bloggers in order to have the opportunity to see firsthand. I think, generally speaking, they're appreciative of the dialogue. I think, we're very proud at U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance that folks like Michael Pollan, for an example, that maybe would have stretched in areas of sharing information around food production, now looks at organizations like the farmers of this country to keep those messages in check. And that's a very powerful thing.
Sure.
Don't you find it interesting, though, Dennis, that the parts of the world, Rwanda, that they are receiving information as power to grow more food, we take that for granted here. Is that just a fact that we've never been hungry?
That we never what? What was the last?
That we've never been hungry.
Right, that's true. And I think so, you know, it's the thing that's one of the challenges, too, is so, right, we had an agricultural extension system. We had a land grant system. This has been all part of our DNA for more than a century. And so part of this is this, how do you actually create an environment for success in places that don't even have the civil infrastructure? And it's a long-term challenge. And yet we have to do what we can to try to provide opportunities so people in these other locations, if we have the expertise and the knowledge, then provide the opportunities so that they can help themselves.
Who else? Sir. We get right in the middle. Microphone's on the way. And then I'll come back to you. I saw another hand over there to the left.
Last year in the Super Bowl, there was a Dodge truck commercial that replayed the Paul Harvey commentary, God Made a Farmer. In the research for your film, not about trucks, but about farmers, did you do any back tracking on the demographic that was targeted at, and notice any, did it help get the word out? And if so, a second question I had was, you mentioned that you're hitting, I think, 25 targeted areas for the release of the film.
Right.
Are you targeting specific demographics in those high-volume areas?
So I'll start with that. The marketing effort certainly does. We are trying to skew younger every way we can, particularly with the media that we're targeting, entertainment media. We're watching very carefully. The music that's in the film today isn't what will ultimately be in the film 2 weeks from now. And we're trying to use, you know, entertainment names in recording that music that helps us. All that comes with a price, so there's just so much we can do. But yeah. But who lays the music over something like this is very important. And I know my 18-year-old son is paying very close attention on whether or not it's, you know, Bon Jovi's guitar player or Everclear or whoever it might be, right? So it's important that the... God Made a Farmer piece is hard to match, right? It's particularly hard to match in agriculture. Now, I would leave it to Ram to tell you how well that ad did with consumers, but it certainly did well with agriculture. And, you know, you've got it. You only wish for that with the consumers. And, again, I just mentioned that as important as this film is, the agricultural audience is will help us get the ball rolling, but it's certainly not the target.
I was incredibly intrigued by that ad because I think what it does is it actually speaks directly to the challenge that we as communicators face. It's one thing to have the facts, it's one thing to have the information, but if you can grab them around the neck emotionally, that makes a huge difference. And that, it was like, that was the one thing I remember from that whole night, was that.
Yeah. You know,
okay.
I've got a very quick story, and I know some in the room have heard it before, but I was at the FFA convention sitting with a group of 15 and 16-year-old kids. Of course, they thought I was ancient, and we started having the conversation about what's the first thing you remembered in your life, what was that moment. Well, I don't remember the Kennedy assassinations. I don't remember Martin Luther King, but I remember the Challenger. That's my big moment. One of the young ladies at the table, they started sharing theirs. Michael Jackson came up. Her moment was that commercial. That was her moment. She was sitting watching that commercial with her parents and looked over and her dad was crying. She's a farm girl from Oklahoma. And her dad was crying sitting there watching that ad. So very powerful for agriculture, no question.
It's such a great question and it's so relevant because this is the challenge in storytelling, right? How do you connect with the head but grab the heart? And do you do one at the peril of the other? And there are very few examples and moments and opportunities where you can really do both and hit it out of the park.
We confront that challenge in every story that we do. It's how do you, it's what they call it, the head and the chakras. It's like you have to engage them both. You can't engage the emotional at the expense of the intellectual, and you can't do the intellectual without emotional, because then it's like medicine. And then if it's just emotional, it's not grounded in some sense of reality. So we're always, everything we do is trying to find the balance between those two things.
Another question. I think there was somebody in the back.
Michelle Payne Knoper. Curious, since you both work on national platforms specific to North America, one of the things that I hear over and over is that we have no sex appeal in agriculture. And how do we actually find some sex appeal? And I don't mean that in any nasty sense. But the point is without the sensationalism, without the misinformation, without all the tactics that we see people use against agriculture, if there was one nugget that both of you could share from your experience on the national platform and being able to appeal to the non-agriculture audience, what would that nugget be?
You. Folks like you that are out there in social media, I think it's incredibly effective. It is hard to find what, you know, how we'll get to consumers and what necessarily the nugget will be. But I truly believe that farmers telling the stories. I mean, I think we've just turned the corner with this. I think we've learned how to do it more effective. We've got almost 10,000 farmers out there that we've worked to and worked with and trained how to do this. So, you know, my sense is that, you know, we try to be sexy with the music in the film. We're trying to do those kinds of things. But truly, fear marketing overcomes a lot of that, and I don't think that it's right for agriculture to respond with fear marketing back at fear marketing.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of the question, but I guess if I were to try to say one thing, it would be, do you know where your food comes from, and if not, you should. That, to me, would be perhaps the summation of what we're trying to do.
She said we were both sexy. That's how she started it.
Oh, great. Well, thanks. I'll tell my two college-age daughters about that. Would you tweet that out to them? They'll really dig on that.
We'll put you in the next swimsuit edition.
Thank you.
I would actually like to respond to that, if I may, because it's something that I've worked with a lot. And actually, if you think about having just watched the Olympics, there's a story there. And this is something that Rune Arledge invented and discovered when he did this, and that's people. People remember people. People connect with people. So if you ask a lot of people, what do you remember from the Olympics, they may remember that skier, the first thing he did was to go over and embrace his brother who had cerebral palsy, right? We did, through this project that I mentioned, we sent some students to Africa to find agriculture innovators on the ground in Africa and let them tell their own stories, stories from the bottom up, not from the top down. And they came back, they found this amazing young woman in Kenya who was working in the slums of Kibera, which is the largest slum in Kenya, in Nairobi, with women crafting these biomass fuel briquettes to replace wood for these indoor cook stoves that kill 400,000 people or more a year in Africa alone. And she was this young, unbelievably dynamic, beautiful woman who stood up and talked about this. And we crafted this into her story. And it was so compelling, we brought her to Washington for the event. She then met with students. But then she started telling the story about how when she was a little girl, she would walk to the woods every day to cut wood for the stove. And as she got older, the woods got farther and farther away because the woods were being cut down. To the point now where a typical woman in the slum could spend 2 days a week just gathering fuel. And it's what motivated her to do this. Her story was so compelling that she got students who are now trying to raise money for her. I mean, I think this personal... And you can't do that with everything.
I think that one thing that we try to do that differentiates us. And it's one thing to tell a story. It's another thing to witness it.
Yeah.
To be there, to see the life unfold and change. And it's one thing to tell the story of somebody who had to raise a calf. It's another thing to actually be a journalist who goes out there and watches the whole thing and then goes back a week later, goes back for maybe a year. And you build a different kind of narrative, you tell a different kind of story, and if you're a photographer, we have to be there when things are happening. We can't just go in and take a picture. That, to me, is the differentiating thing about what we do. Unfortunately, or fortunately, it requires a great investment of time and patience. And so our writers are writing about things. They try to build scenes in the mind of readers, take people places so that they can imagine what it's like to be inside somebody's barn or in the see what I mean or my trip. And the same thing with the photography. It's like we're in the business of bearing witness for others, and that is one way to make these stories more compelling.
Let's see if we've got another question or two, and then we'll let people move on to dinner. Anybody else? No? Did I miss a hand? No? I'm going to close with asking you one last question each, just briefly, and that is, what surprised you, or what did you learn from these very big projects? You're people who know this stuff really well, but there's always something that you learn or that surprises you when you dig this deep. So I'm just curious, you know, what your takeaway was.
Well, we're not done, but one thing that fascinated me about this project, we're still in motion. I mean, we're still building stories. But what struck me was I started agitating for this thing about 3 years ago. It takes a while to make these things work. And what struck me most dramatically was, like, all of a sudden, people all over the magazine were wanting to get involved. it was like it was a thing that it's like you're kind of like the little preacher who goes around and says, you know, this is something that we need to do. And then people took it on themselves to take their own responsibility, to move the ball forward. It's like this is an idea that took on a life of its own. And I've just been able to kind of like, wow, look at this. That to me was, that in one sense, beyond doing the projects, watching people engage and step up and see that there's power in doing this was what's really been impressive to me.
Randy?
I think the striking thing was, you know, James Mull selected these farmers and ranchers, and he conversed with them. And the striking piece out of it all was that their concern around public perception, that, you know, they're all dealing with water issues, weather issues, profit issues, all sorts of stuff going on around them. But they're very conscious, whether it's out in the middle of Nebraska or a local producer in Pennsylvania, they are very, very connected with what the consumer is saying and what they can personally do about it.
Great. Can I thank both of these gentlemen for your great perspective? And
thank you.
And also for your terrific work. I this is so important to get this level of communication out there, and it's hard to do because it takes time and it takes money, and then you got to market it and then you got to pursue it. So really, good luck with it. It's just fabulous.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for
being here.
Yeah.
I want to just a couple announcements, and then we'll let everybody get on their way. First of all, I wonder if we've got all of our presenters and panelists and others, both from today and for tomorrow, in the room, or for those of you who are here, could you just stand up so we could all see you all? And there we go. Mommy Dweeb. Mama Dweeb. I want to thank you. And if anybody wants to connect with you, we know where you are. You can run, but you can't hide. I'd also like to make an announcement that's a special pleasure to share with you all, and that is that Bayer Crop Science, in recognition of the importance of the topic and the need to share, is making a produce donation in the honor of this gathering to the San Antonio Food Bank. More than 1,800 pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables is going to the food bank from local suppliers, largely from this county that we're gathered in, certainly this part of Texas. They estimate it will provide about 1,400 meals for people in need in southwest Texas. So thanks to Bayer Crop Science for doing that. So we've reached the end of day one. Now comes the part.